Well, thank you, Ron, and let me add a very big, warm welcome on this chilly day on behalf of Vanderbilt. The Thinking Out of the Lunchbox program has been one of Vanderbilt's most successful partnerships ever, and we are grateful to the Downtown Library, to Donna Nicely, to Ron, and all the others to allow us to gather in this world-class facility to hear world-class thinkers like you're going to hear today and have in the past. One of the great things about working at a university, and Vanderbilt in particular, is that we get to have these kinds of intellectual discussions every day on our campus, the kinds that you're going to hear about in the next hour. And we are delighted that we can bring these types of discussions and debates to downtown Nashville. Thank you for attending today. I know you will go away fed mentally and physically, and we hope that you'll return time and time again, and I know many of you do because I see some regulars here, and that's great. Now it's my pleasure to introduce David Wood, who is a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt, and he's the creator and the leader of this Lunchbox series. It could not happen without him and his dedication and commitment. David is one of our most engaging and active faculty members, and we are so happy to have him. And for those of you who are Lunchbox regulars, you know that David asks provocative questions and leads interesting and stimulating conversations. So I present to you Professor David Wood.
Well, thank you, Ron, and thank you, Beth, and thank you for coming back to the first of this new season, new spring season of Thinking Out of the Lunchbox talks. Richard Blackett, our speaker today, was born in Trinidad and educated in England. He's held distinguished academic positions at Indiana and Houston, and since 2002, he's been the Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt. Richard's the author of numerous articles and four books: Building an Anti-Slavery Wall, Black Americans in the Atlantic Abolitionist Movement from 1830 to 1860, Beating Against the Barriers, they're all wonderful titles, Biographical Essays in 19th Century Afro-American History, Thomas Morris Chester, Black Civil War Correspondent, and lastly, Divided Hearts, Britain and the American Civil War. In it, he looks into the complex history of British popular reactions to the Civil War. He's a world authority on Afro-American history, on Caribbean history, and in particular on the history of slavery. His research focuses on the place of African Americans in the Atlantic world, especially their efforts to end slavery and racial discrimination. He sits on more than a dozen committees and editorial boards, including the Association of Caribbean Historians, Civil War History, and the Journal of Negro History. Well, in 1853 and 54, in his old age, Tennessee's own Montgomery Ward sent quite a number Let's start that again. Montgomery Bell sent quite a number of his hundreds of slaves to a colony in Liberia, founded by the American Colonization Society, and even bought these slaves land on which they could practice the skills in iron forging that he taught them. And yet, on the other hand, this notoriously tight-fisted man spent a lot of money chasing runaway slaves. Was this just the repentance of an 85-year-old guy? Was slavery on its last legs? What does this show us about the time that was only a decade before the Civil War? Well, we could not have a better guide in trying to answer these questions than today's guest, Professor Richard Blackett. Richard.
Thank you, David. Thank you all for what a nice crowd. Makes me feel important. The slip that David made between calling him Montgomery Ward has more to do with what we were drinking back in the room before we came out.
<on. laughs>
I hope there's more of it after too. My talk today stems from a tradition that I have developed wherever I have lived. I try to do a little bit of local history. It gets me into the society in which I am working. And I came to Montgomery Bell partly because we live very close to the school called Montgomery Bell Academy, and I have to drive past this school. And years ago I was at the Nashville Archives and asked the local librarian about Montgomery Bell, and she showed me a copy of his will, which I read. And one phrase struck me as very interesting, given the present-day academy. It says in the will that it was, the bequest was to open a school for boys, for indigent boys. And I thought, well, something is going awry here. And every time I drive by Montgomery Bell Academy, I have visions of poor indigent lads trying to cross Harding. I hope there are no Montgomery Bell Academy people in here. a couple of years ago, working on another project, I ran across in a newspaper a short item about Montgomery Bell freeing his slaves and sending them to Liberia on the west coast of Africa. I asked a local librarian, why did Bell do such a thing? And was met with a sort of knowing look, a twinkle in the eye, and the information that Bell was a bachelor, and that is all the person said. I didn't know the person, I didn't know the librarian, and well enough, anyway, to ask what it all meant. But I thought the inference was very clear. Bachelors do things with women over whom they have command. But we'll get back to Mr. Bell on that score later on. So who was Montgomery Bell? A brief sort of biographical sketch. He was born in Chester County, Pennsylvania in 1769, moved first to Kentucky and then to Tennessee, where he bought a furnace from James Robinson, who obviously is a very prominent name in local history, in 1804. By the time he took the decision to send his slaves to Liberia in the early 1850s, Bell was the state's most prominent ironmaster. The 1850 slave schedules recorded he owned 310 slaves. Let me repeat that, 310 slaves. That's like all of you all in here. Making him possibly the largest slaveholder in the state. A historian of Dixon County, where most of Bell's furnaces and forges were located, had this to say about him. He was a ruthless slave driver who made hard bargains, who became wealthy exploiting Dixon County, who may even have had, and here we go, illegitimate white and black children. He was an equal opportunity. But who in later years became imbued with a philanthropic spirit and emancipated slaves and gave money for the establishment of a school for boys. Much is implied here, but much is left unsaid. Others called him an unscrupulous businessman who in old age decided to free and send his slaves to Liberia. Why Liberia? Liberia was founded by the American Colonization Society in 1822 as a place to settle freed slaves and free blacks who no longer wished to remain in the United States. The argument being that in a society in which racism flourished and in which slavery appeared to be growing, anyone, any slaveholder, who was partial to freeing his slaves, ran into the problem of where to settle them, where they could go once they were freed. Most southern states made it impossible for people who were freed to remain in those states unless they got special dispensation from the legislature. So for the American Colonization Society, it had a sort of schizophrenic history and character. On the one hand, it saw itself as an anti-slavery organization, and for many members, it was also an organization that got rid of free blacks as being the most dangerous people within a slave society. So the tension in the American Colonization Society existed between those who saw themselves as anti-slavery and those who saw themselves as fighting for the expansion and consolidation of slavery. Like many societies of its kind and times, it relied for its support and funds from local chapters. The Tennessee Colonization Society was founded in 1829, had a very checkered career and history, but by the early 1850s had been revived under the leadership of a group of men including Nathaniel Cross, who was professor of languages at the University of Nashville, the Reverend Philip Lindsay, who was president of the university, Francis Fogg, and others, many of whom were to become prominent figures in educational circles in the city. Much of the local chapter's activities centered on raising money to cover the cost of outfitting and settling blacks from the state in Liberia, and lobbying state government to do as other southern state governments had done and appropriate money to the cause. In 1854, Tennessee adopted a law which stipulated that freed slaves had to be sent to Liberia. Funds to cover the cost of passage and support was to be provided by the slaveholder. If no funds were provided, the clerk of court must hire out the slave until enough money was raised to send them to Liberia. An interesting emancipation concept. 20 years earlier, a law transferred $10 to the American Colonization Society for every free Negro removed to Liberia. The efforts to raise funds for the enterprise was never very successful here and elsewhere. By 1853, when Bell made his decision to send his slaves to Liberia, the society was in desperate financial straits. It put out an appeal asking 1,000 supporters to donate $10 each to cover operating expenses. As the society's monthly newspaper put it rather indelicately, "We want money, we must have it, or our cause will suffer a great damage." Sounds like something my children do to me. We must have money. As a result, Bell and others in the state who wished to send their slaves to Liberia would have to foot much of the bill, and the bill was pretty steep. It was estimated that it cost $60 to outfit and support for 6 months each immigrant. That's $60 in 1850 money. For every large group of immigrants sent to Liberia, the society would have to appeal to a benefactor to cover much of the cost of the expedition. Why does Montgomery Bell approach the American Colonization Society? In late 1853, the society's Tennessee agent wrote Washington, D.C., where the national office was located, informing them that Bell had 200 slaves, or as he put it, 200 servants. And it's interesting, as you read these documents, very rarely do the slaveholders call these people slaves. They call them servants, they call them my people, they call them my Negroes, but never slaves. The Bell had 200 servants that he wished to settle in Liberia, 100 of them direct descendants of James Morley, the slave who came to Tennessee with Bell and for whom Bell named one of his forges in Dixon County. Roughly 80 of the proposed groups were mechanics who had built sawmills, grist mills, furnaces, and forges for rolling mills. This was indeed a skilled group of slaves. But this question still lingers. Why Bell's sudden interest in freeing his slave? There's some suggestion that he had been mulling over the possibilities of freeing all his slaves for some time. If that were so, then under Tennessee law, he would have to send the freed people out of the country. But it seems equally likely that Bell was growing increasingly anxious, and this is a word that crops up in all of the letters, increasingly anxious that his death would lead to an unseemly scramble by family members for his property. His friend and confidant, Nathaniel Cross, said Bell anticipated trouble from what he described as his collateral heirs. I have never heard of the phrase before. Should he die before his slaves leave? Part of his concern stemmed obviously from his advanced age and his growing feebleness. Friends spoke of signs of physical infirmity and mental feebleness. But those who knew him well described him as a man of peculiar temperament who made his will, it was said, and disposed of his servants only to later undo all that he had done. Bell evidently wrote wills twice a month and once every fortnight or whatever it was. And you have a vision of him doing this and seeing what the reaction of his family would be like, and then he would change it again. I suppose at age 85, with no family to look after, it is one of the joys of life. Bell was also influenced by a spike in interest in colonization in Nashville and surrounding counties in the early 1850s. There were inquiries from places like Murfreesboro, McMinnville, Rutherford County, and other areas around in the area about the settlement of former slaves in Liberia. By far the most significant was the decision of William Kennedy, the Columbia lawyer and slave holder, who freed and sent the first group of his slaves to Liberia in 1852. The first group of Kennedy slaves sailed from New Orleans in December 1852, and a second group was to follow in the spring. Bell planned to send 70 or 80 of his servants on this first trip. He would cover half the cost of outfit them and to get them to the ship if the American Colonization Society agreed to cover all other expenses. Not uncharacteristically, Bell made a number of additional demands on the society. He wanted to know if he could buy 2,000 acres of land on which to settle the immigrants, land near water to power the mills and forges they planned to establish. When it appeared that was not possible, he insisted that his company be settled with those of Kennedy's on land where there were known iron ore deposits. The society insisted that only the government of Liberia could grant such a request, but promised to approach the government as well as to initiate a survey of iron ore producing lands in the colony. By the way, iron ore would become Liberia's most important asset until the founding of rubber in the 20th century. Although it is not clear if Bell's people made any contribution to that development. Bell also insisted that the company not be sent through New Orleans. He knew how many of Kennedy's company died on the last emigrant ship to leave the port the previous December. In response, the society agreed that his and Kennedy's second company would join the ship in Savannah. In the end, only 38 made up the first company out of Savannah in December 1853. It was headed by Thomas Scott, the patriarch of the family, who was rumored to have helped to produce the cannonballs used by Andrew Jackson in the Battle of New Orleans. Let me just show you the ship manifest here. For those of you in the back, I'm sorry. You just have to take my word. There's Thomas Scott. This is the ship manifest, and it lists, and you can see many Scott names, and they're all traveling as a group, as family. This is in 1853. I'll save this one for next. These trips usually tried the souls of the immigrants. There was the cross-country trip to the ship from here to Savannah in a period before rails. In this and other trips, the society hired an agent to protect and guide the group of freed people through slaveholding territory. The immigrants usually took too much baggage with them. Local police officials in port cities like Havana were on constant lookout for ways to exploit the situation, and many of them had to be paid off. The immigrants had to wait for days to embark. Local labor had to be found to load the ship, and to crown it all, the voyage took an average of 40 days. And as one local person said, it was hotter than hell. If the experience of Kennedy's first group of immigrants were anything to go by, it was likely Montgomery Bell's people would lose many of their possessions, and when they got to Liberia, they would have to wait for weeks before receiving their allowance. The expedition to Liberia landed, and I'll just show you quickly. This is the coast of Liberia. There's the capital, Monrovia. And as you will see, all the settlements are on the coast. And you can't have iron forging on the coast. Something's wrong with that. But the Bell people would land in Sino. And later on, the iron ore industry would develop to the north of Liberia, which is not on that map. As you can see also, these settlements are on the mouths of rivers into the interior. As in the case of most of the immigrants to Liberia, little is known of the first company of immigrants who landed in early 1854. We do know that within 6 months of their arrival, they sent back to the United States to Bell what was called a bar of iron, which suggested to the society, at least, that the lands back in of Sinoy held rich deposits of iron ore. Bell's second company, within weeks of the departure of the first company, friends of Bell were reporting to the society that he was ready to send out a second company. The group, which left in May 1854, comprised 49 immigrants. You will notice also that there are people from Williamson County on the trip, the Douglas slaves. I can't get into them. And there is Kennedy from Murray County, his second group of slaves. And there's Montgomery Bell. And notice here he is described as coming from Williamson County. By 1850, Bell had moved to Williamson County, where he lived 4 years before going back to Dixon County. There's another manifest which lists the other. But for the second group of immigrants go out on two separate ships. There was rumor of a third group of people, Kennedy reported that Bell was planning to offer an additional 200 Iron Men, as they were called, to the society if they could join members of early expeditions and if the Liberian government were willing to grant additional lands on which to build and run ironworks to be named in honor of Bell. The prospects seemed good. For such an outcome as all sent to the United States for analysis a few months later was declared, as one report said, to be the best and richest iron ore in the world. But among his family, there was widespread suspicion that Bell was not only losing his marbles, but that he was frittering away his assets in a misguided scheme. If you consider that there were 49 people on the second expedition, 38 on the first, 200 more, and that doesn't leave much between that and 310, if my math is correct. Bell turned to one of his trusted nephews, a man called George Bain, who he asked to accompany the third company. Bain was to travel to London to purchase machinery to be used in the projected foundry to be established in Liberia. But interestingly, not only family members were opposed to the plan for another expedition, some of Bell's slaves had other ideas. And it's an interesting tale, this one. I'm not sure how it resolves itself, nor am I sure exactly what stimulated the first action. But a couple of his trusted slaves, a man named Joe Hall and another second called Jim Burris, had been leased to Bell's nephew, a man called James Bell, who lived somewhere outside of Nashville. Montgomery Bell, in sending Burris and Hall to his nephew, gave them an envelope stuffed with $3,500 and said to them, please give this to my nephew. The money, evidently, was to be sent to the leader of the first company that went out under Thomas Scott in Liberia to help pay for the establishment of the iron forges, as well as to support some of the immigrants that had gone out and to see them through the hardships of their first settlement. Burris and Hall had other ideas. $3,500. But they came up with an ingenious scheme. They divided it in half or something. You could imagine them sitting around working out what they should do. They divided it in half and sent half on to Thomas Scott through the American Colonization Society office and used the other half to make their way to freedom in Ohio. They ran off with the loot. Interestingly, I found an advertisement for Burris and Hall in the local newspaper. Let me read it. Run away from the subscriber about the 21st of August, two Negroes, Joe Hall and Jim Burris. Joe is a black Negro, about 24 years old, 6'1" high. He's a big lad, very stout, but not fleshy. Weighs about 180 pounds, has a scar on one of his cheekbones caused by a burn, can read and write. That means he could write his own passes to get out of here. Jim is a copper-colored Negro with a peculiar yellowness about the eyes, He sounded as though he was drinking too much of that stuff. About 60 years or 5 feet 9 high and weighs about 175 pounds. They have a large amount of money with them in notes on the Bank of Tennessee. And I should add, the reason I found this is that I found a letter from the president of the Bank of Tennessee saying, I need to get my money back. They are both keen, shrewd Negroes and possibly have forged free papers with them. It is also probable that they may be traveling under the control and guidance of a white man. Always, in all of this, there's always a white man lurking in the background. As if these guys, faced with $3,500, couldn't work it out themselves. The above reward will be given for their apprehension. That's $300. That's an amazing amount of money. And I suspect it's not because of the value of Joe or Jim, but of the amount of money, cash in their pockets. The above reward will be given for their apprehension and delivery to me or to the jail in Nashville. The third company, plans for a third company, fell apart when, on April 1st, and only Bell could do this, on April 1st, Bell died. His death cut short plans for the settlement, for further settlement in Liberia. In the end, one is still unsure of Bell's motives, for he has left no record of why he decided, in the 2 years before his death, to free and send his people to Liberia. Friends such as Cross spoke of a long-held desire to free a people to whom he was deeply attached. The cynic wonders why it took him so long. After all, he had been a slaveholder for over 50 years. His friend Kennedy may have reflected some of his views when he described colonization as the grandest benevolent enterprise of its time, a movement that was better for the Negro and even better for the white man. There is no evidence that Bell came to the decision because many of those he freed were his offsprings. But his last will insisted the executors sell his remaining slaves to what he called good masters, and that families not be separated. Years later, I was working reading a Missouri newspaper. Don't ask me why, do you think? I was reading a Missouri newspaper and came up, you can't see, it's a very bad reproduction, so my secretary kindly typed it up. The undersigned receivers of Montgomery Bell deceased will offer for sale at public auction at Valley Forge in Dixon County, Tennessee, 3 miles southeast of Charlotte, commencing on Tuesday, the 10th day of February 1856, and 140 Negroes consisting of men, women, and children, many of them skilled in every department of the iron business, forgemen, keepers, fillers, furnace men, molders, colliers, blacksmiths, wagoners, engineers, and the majority of the women and children excellent farm hands. The said slaves will be sold on 12 months credit and as families as far as practicable. Negro traders, and then there's an ellipses, are prohibited by the will from purchasing of any of the said slaves. Montgomery Bell's ears got hold of some of the slaves. In the end, one is left wondering still why Montgomery Bell decided to free and send his slaves to Liberia. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We're going to start off with just a couple of questions from me, and then we'll open the discussion to the floor. You know, it's really interesting listening to a historian. I mean, I'm not a historian. sometimes I think I look at the world through rose-tinted spectacles, and I imagine that change, social change, takes place because people are convinced by arguments, you know, justice should be done, and so on. And so when I listen to the complexity with which you lay out the possible motives that Montgomery Bell might have had for sending his people to Liberia, I start realizing that history may not be quite as pure as I would like to have thought. And that takes me back to a book I once read, and I forget the author, about the end of slavery. I guess it was the abolition of slavery probably in England, which is, I think, 1833, roughly, which is three decades before here. And I had thought that people had, as it were, thought through these issues, and there had been lots of, discussion and argument in Parliament, in the public, about the immorality of slavery. And my thought was, well, yes, and eventually this became obvious, and people just decided to abolish it and get rid of it and outlaw it throughout the colonies and so on. Whereas here, in this country, it didn't quite happen like that. There was a war, and that's, I guess, how it ended. But I'm curious to know whether, as a historian, what role you think, this is one of those big, huge questions, but what role do you think principles like justice or fairness or equality or with these big ideas play in history and might have played in the ending of slavery? Because the other alternative explanation would be, well, slavery became uneconomic, too expensive to keep slaves, and there were better forms of management available. I mean, do you as a historian sort of go down one of these paths or the other path? I mean, how do you...
Yeah. Historians are notoriously wishy-washy, so let me follow in that long-held tradition. It's an honored tradition. Ideas mattered. It's clear that ideas mattered. But in the end, one has to ask the question of somebody like Montgomery Bell, how does someone who has been eagerly and happily going along exploiting labor, 300-odd scattered all over Nashville and surrounding counties, decide at one point that he ought to free his slaves? And it's not an, I don't know if I have an answer, as I suggested in the talk. It is clear that for many of us, the problem is that Bell, the letters that I have seen that are signed by Bell are clearly not written by Bell. He just puts his signature at the bottom, and it's it's spidery and it's shaky, because after all, when he is making these inquiries, he's well into his 80s. He may be, the writer may be expressing his views, and it is clear, at least among his friends, that Bell had been given this idea some thought for some time. And there are a number of his contemporaries who were also given this idea some thought for some time, but they are confronted by a number of very difficult situations. One, the law makes it impossible for you to free your slaves and keep them here, which is what these people want to do. And let me just add, there's a great deal of negotiation between the slaveholder and their slaves about their future. It is not something that Bell says, this is what you will do. It is clear that there's negotiation, people saying only under certain circumstances. And one of the circumstances, as you would see from his will, is that people want to remain where their families are. And the families are here, so they don't want to be freed and sent to some godforsaken place on the west coast of Africa that nobody knows anything about. I mean, that's a hell of a thing. It's that they're sending you off to a place where you have absolutely no connections. The fact that the people decided to accept that tells you something about their urge to be free, that they are willing to forego all the things that they know. It's difficult to say with any certainty where ideas are the driving force and where
other kinds of things enter the debate. It is clear that I think that that Bell was, and I don't know why it is, but Bell clearly wants to give the old. I don't want to be rude. Wants to give the old digit to some of his family members. It's clearly that he is just being difficult. And all his contemporaries keep saying the letters have these wonderful phrases about that say that Bell is a loose cannon, that he's a nice man, but you know we can't really keep him on target and on subject. He keeps changing, and he has the power to change. So I have only seen one will, but it's clear from the evidence, from the letters, that there were numerous wills that he wrote. And in every one of those wills, his family, his collateral heirs, are not being treated kindly in their view. So it's hard to tell where one stops and another thing begins.
I want to ask you then just one more question, and that's a personal question. You're born in Trinidad, and you're writing and thinking about African American slaves in this country. What difference do you think it makes to your work and your thinking to have that kind of lineage, that kind of background, compared to somebody who might have had ancestors who were African American slaves? I mean, does it position you differently as a historian?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I've never thought about it. I was the reason I became a historian is that I have no skills.
That's why I became a philosopher.
I could just tell stories. I really have no skills. So I had to find a profession. I mean, it was suggested that I be a lawyer, and I'll be damned if I'll ever become a lawyer. So I had to do something else. I grew up, when I was going through high school, I was, Trinidad and Tobago was still a colony of England. So I was taught Tudor history. Now I want you to understand this. I did Tudor history in high school. Anything you want to know about Tudor history, I think I may still be able to answer it. But when I decided to switch from Tudor England, I just did one of these things and put my hand up. I went as a graduate student. I also became in 1960s. 1960s were an interesting time for those of us who came of age in the 1960s. Stuff was happening everywhere. Stuff was happening in the United States. It was happening in Europe. It was happening in England, and particularly the civil rights movement caught my attention. So that, I think, is my entree. And because I couldn't understand what was happening in the civil rights movement, I thought I ought to go back and try and find its antecedents. And in searching for its antecedents, I landed in the 19th century. I haven't left since. So that basically is it. That's one roundabout answer.
Okay. We're going to take questions from the floor now for a few minutes, and I'll ask Richard just to write them down, and then when we've got a bunch of them, we'll give him a few minutes at the end just to address all of them in one go. Okay.
I have two questions.
Two?
Yes. Do you know where in Williamson County Montgomery Bell lived, and do you know how the population of Montgomery Bell Academy, the school, changed from indigent to however we would describe it now?
Thank you. Okay. Is there a question? Yes, a lady in the red here.
Okay. Where these people were sent, was there already a settlement there, or did they have to just dig in and clear land and build homes? And then also, do we know what happened to them later? Did they stay and become the country of Liberia, or did there some of them go back to the United States? Thank you.
Thanks. Good question right at the back there.
Mm-hmm. Me?
Yep.
Yes, sir. I have two questions and a little personal anecdote.
What is it? Is this a Nashville thing to have more than one question?
Hey, you're in a city of academia.
Okay.
I had an ancestor from Franklin County, Estelle Springs, who gave his slaves to his heirs. He placed zero value on each individual so they wouldn't fight over who got the greater part of the estate. Two questions. One, my impression is that in 1860, at the onset of the war, Tennessee had the highest percentage of free blacks of any state in the South in the Confederacy, and that was approximately 10%. Do you know anything about that? And number two, did an evangelical movement play a role in these organizations that were attempting to free and send back to Liberia these individuals? Thank you so much. I've enjoyed your discussion greatly.
Yes, there's a lady down here.
Well, this is a question about somebody on the mountain. I never did understand why slaves were on the mountain because they couldn't raise cotton up there. But this was up in Rome County, where the hills are really steep in Tennessee. And this man named John Rice had slaves. And in his will in 1815, he said that such and such slaves will not be separated. They evidently were husband and wife, really, because he said, because they're old and I don't want them separated. Now, but they had to be sold. The government, you know, they made you do an inventory and you had to even tell how many roosters you had. So, what I'm asking is, when a slave owner asked that these slaves not be separated because they loved one another and they were old, was that honored? Because I tried and tried to find whatever happened to those two slaves that he didn't want separated. What was the law on that? Thank you.
Thank you. There's a gentleman that, yep.
Thoroughly enjoyed the presentation. Quick question. Have you come across any correlations between Marcus Garvey's later movement towards Liberia and what you're currently speaking about during the emancipation era? When I first learned of the emancipation of enslaved Africans and the movement towards Liberia, it struck a chord with me. I was like, wow, that's very interesting to know that this actually took place prior to Marcus Garvey's whole initiative towards Liberia.
Thank you. Yes. Another idea.
Did the advent of technology have anything to do with his letting those people go? Perhaps he didn't need them any longer. And did letting them go have an effect upon his business?
Yeah, another question.
In your research, did you run across the name of Lincoln? Because he had that same idea of colonizing the...
You mean Abe?
Yes.
How are we doing? Do you need any more? Oh, there's another question here. Yeah.
I was just wondering if there was also a gold rush in Liberia at some point, kind of at the same time of the gold rush in the United States, and if that has something to do with the economics.
Would you like to make a start on this?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, no. Where in Williamson County you lived, I think someone asked. It's somewhere on the first exit if you get off 65, after you pass that horrendous statue. That obscene looking thing on the left. I haven't managed to find out exactly where it is, Because, but if you are a member of the library and you go to ancestry.com and you type in Montgomery Bell, he comes up in 1850 as living in Williamson County, and he has hundreds and hundreds of slaves just listed under him. If you go to slave schedules for 1850, you would see similar sorts of things. But it doesn't give you a precise location of where he lived in Williamson County. So I can't answer that with any certainty. Now, as to Montgomery Bell Academy, I don't think it was ever an academy for indigent boys. I think they simply ignored the old man and went about their business. I think what they did, and I stand to be corrected on this, I think they provided scholarships for people who could not afford to attend. And in that way then met the terms of the will without it being a place where lots of poor kids are just running around being made into gentlemen in the future. Were there settlements in Liberia before? Yes. I mean, these are, I showed the coast, the map of the coast of Liberia. There were settlements along, throughout the coast of Liberia. And what, it's an interesting history in that many of the state societies, like the Pennsylvania Society, Colonization Society, the Maryland Colonization Society, created their own settlements that they sent people from those states to. So you have a separate, independent, almost, settlement called Maryland in Liberia. You had Pennsylvania in Liberia. And it wasn't until 1847, when Liberia became independent, that all of those different settlements were brought together. And the idea of the settlements is to try and keep as many people together from a particular area. That is why Kennedy's and Bell's people and others from... when Kennedy's first group goes out in late 1852, they settle in areas where people from Maury County had already settled. In fact, they settled among people who, family members that had gone before. In fact, one of the people who accompanied the 1852 expedition out to Liberia with Kennedy's people was a man called Robert Kennedy, who was clearly a slave of Kennedy, and who had gone out earlier and had returned in order, as he said, to clear up some business transactions. What is impressive, I discovered, is that the regularity with which people went back and forth between Liberia and the United States. There's constant traffic, particularly of well-known figures who either after settling in Liberia constantly returned to the United States on a regular basis. So there's constant movement across the Atlantic. And that's not peculiar to Liberia. That is happening throughout the world, throughout the Atlantic world in the 19th century. People move constantly. I discovered this in the last book I was doing as I tried to track one person who was involved in pro-union activities in Britain, and I kept losing him every 6 months, and I didn't know where the hell he was, and I didn't know how to find him until I discovered that he was there. He was at a meeting in Boston. What is he doing in a meeting? I go to Boston, I can't find him after this meeting. He's back in Manchester in 6 months. So people are moving back and forth, working across the Atlantic, and this is a constant, this is a pattern that is common throughout this period. Was non-separation honored by the slaveholders, the descendants of the slaveholders? That's really hard to tell, but it was a commitment on the part of many of the slaveholders. I think they recognized the extent to which families had stayed together and therefore ought to remain together as long as possible. But at the same time, there is a tradition when necessary, of separating families. You cannot read a single slave narrative of the 19th century without seeing families being separated. In the end, the financial well-being of the master mattered more than the family connections of his slaves. But many people like Bell and others tried to keep families together as best they could. Marcus Garvey, Liberia, Free Slave Connection. When Garvey comes along with his Back to Africa movement in the period after the First World War, there are only two independent black nations in the world, Liberia and Ethiopia, and Haiti, sorry. So that for Garvey, the options are not very great. And Liberia and the connection between Liberia and the United States had remained very strong. And as Garvey said, Africa for the Africans, he assumed that he could take control, he could try and take control and work with the people in Liberia. So I think that explains the connection rather than anything else. I don't know about the advent of technology, you know. I mean, Bell's slaves are the cream of the crop in terms of they are the artisans in this period. They are the skilled laborers. They are the people who are most technologically sophisticated. They ran the shop. Bell named, as I said, named one of his forges after one of his freed slaves. And for those of you who have been down to Dixon County along the Harpers River, you see they blasted tunnels through incredible rocks in order to set up a system. These are very, very skilled people. And these are people that Bell entrusted much of his business to. So to some extent, one could imagine Bell arguing with his family that they did nothing for him. I think I'm going to get a little, I think this is a wonderful thing. I should get a little bit, sort of, a little bit of Bell in me, as they say. You know, give away my riches before my family gets home. Abraham Lincoln and colonization. Yes, this is a common feature, and Lincoln would stay with this well into the middle of the Civil War, proposing to send free blacks as freedmen and free blacks out of the country, not necessarily to Liberia, but to places in this part of the world, Haiti, places in Central America. Because he saw it as a way of quieting the conflict between Southerners and Northerners over the issue of the future of blacks in American society. It was his way of trying to resolve it. And he remained a steadfast colonizationist until it became apparent that it wasn't bad. People who he was offering this option to were not buying into it. And he also recognized very belatedly that the people who were supposed to be the beneficiaries of this project, black Americans, were not partial to the idea of colonization. This was their country. They said they had fought for it and they had died for it and they intend to keep it their country. After a while, Lincoln, there's a wonderful meeting of Lincoln with a group of black representatives or leaders early during the Civil War, in which he's absolutely stunned by how strongly they are opposed to colonization. That tells you something about where Abe Lincoln was as well. There's no gold rush that I can tell to Liberia. That it's a society and economy that's created by the people who settle there, and if there is a sort of industrial sector to the economy, it becomes the iron ore industry. And I suspect people like Bell's slaves, former slaves, would have been part of that, the development of that industry. But unlike philosophers, historians are limited by evidence. Thank you.